gives me great pleasure to introduce Star from San Francisco.
Star alcoholic.
Star.
Hi, friends. Thanks for being here. I see old friends, a bunch of pals from Orchid, and a bunch of new friends, too. Congratulations, Norm, on 12 days.
Thank you.
And Mary Jane on
7 years.
Thanks. I heard 6 to 10, and I wasn't sure. Good job. I'm Star, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from, my home group is in San Francisco in the dry dock. Has anybody ever been to the dry dock up in the marina in San Francisco? Join us sometime if you've never been there. It's a really good club. There's tons and tons of sobriety there. My home group is the Wednesday morning big book study. And so come on in and make yourself to home, as our current secretary, Detroit Melvin, would say. But anywhere in the world that we go, we can find family. I've been to AA meetings in Oxford, UK. I've been in Barcelona. When I lived in Japan for 3 years, I got to meetings there. My last round of meetings this time around were in Chiang Mai, Thailand, in a room about a quarter the size of this one. And it was full of expats who had gone to Thailand to find shenanigans to get in trouble and found sobriety. And there was something about the nature of their sobriety that I wanted. So, darn, there's no mic. I'm going to have to project. Do you hear me okay in the back?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. I was hoping there was a mic for my mic drop at the end of this. Right? My sobriety date is January 22nd, 2023. Good job showing up for yourselves tonight and for me and for each other. That's what we do in this program. I'm a grateful member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This program saved my life. And several of you in this room are actually managing to do that for me these days too. I'm in town doing caregiving. Probably the hardest job I've ever done in my life is to caregive for family members who are experiencing very quickly progressive dementia. Nothing like the program principle of staying in the present moment and one day at a time, like watching your loved ones lose their grip and ask you the same questions over and over. And ask you, you're not drinking anymore? Really? And that takes me right back to growing up in Orchid. I was born here in 1966. And there's a lot of memories here, there's a lot of stories here, and there's a lot of ghosts, and there's a lot of skeletons. And today I can keep it positive, I can celebrate that I'm here in this spot tonight, not at Shaw's, not at Elmer's, not at all the other spots where people are slowly blotting out their lives, and you guys are here with integrity, with clarity. I can see the clearness in your eyes, Norm. Norm's looking for a sponsor. He just said it right when several of us walked in the room. And that's the beauty of this program. That's the magic of it. So if you take nothing away from this tonight, nothing else, because what I say might be all over the map. It's been a long week. Is about humility. The most important thing to me about my sobriety is keeping humble. Because when someone who's known me for 59 years says, oh, you're not drinking anymore, my first reaction is to say, no, of course not. And you asked me that yesterday, and you asked me that the day before. But in there somewhere is a gift. Somewhere in that type of a question, somewhere in that type of a sideways glance that we get from people who used to know us is an opportunity. I don't always see it. I'm not always humble in the face of that. My hackles stand up sometimes because I don't like to be doubted, because what's happening is you're matching my doubt of myself. Or maybe you're just calling that out. You're reminding me that I doubt myself still this far into my sobriety. I question myself often about it, and that's why I have to come into these rooms and get humble in front of you guys and share a little bit about my story and how I got here, what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. What a great life in a lot of ways it was growing up in Orchid before all the development. When my folks moved here from Minnesota following a semi in a huge snowstorm across country, and when Pops got a job with IT&T or something like that at Vandenberg Air Force Base in the late 50s, they bought a house for $15,000. You can't even get a car for these days. And they started having kids. Dad had come out of the Air Force. He had converted to my mom's religion so that they could get married in her church. And right before they got married, he saw his birth certificate, which had someone else, another parent's name on it. And it was the name of a person he had grown up thinking was his sister. He had been conceived in 1935. And his grandparents sent his mom away to carry him. And then when she got back with him, they said, okay, he's ours now, and raised him like their own. And so it was either when he enlisted or when they got married, he saw his birth certificate and realized that he wasn't who he thought he was. Isn't that a metaphor? It's been a metaphor in my life about, you know, every day, who am I? Who do I think I am right now? Who do I get to be today? That's the question that I get to ask in my sobriety and my recovery. So that was, so we got married and they had 5 kids under 6 years old. So when my twin sister and I were born, they had a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 6-year-old. And they were young, and she stayed home to raise us, and he drove off to work every day. He, over 37 years, he would have 2 heart attacks driving on that dark road between Lompoc or Vandenberg and here, and just drive right through it, just try not to crash. Because, you know, don't tell anybody what's going on with you. Suck it up, get yourself to work. And he did that for 37 years. And somewhere in there, he developed a rage that manifested itself in lots of different ways in the household, mostly taken out on my brothers. But so for me, in my upbringing, there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of insecurity, and I would just start reaching out as I grew up. I would start reaching out for whatever would help me feel safe and secure and comfortable and okay in my own skin and accepted and in control and powerful. And I wouldn't discover alcohol for myself until I was almost 18. But there was a mystique around it growing up, right? Isn't there a mystique around alcohol? Like, no, you don't get to have that until you're grown up. But then at the same time, we were often being told, oh, grow up, right? So there was just a lot of mixed messages. And so to drink meant that you were grown up now, that you were an adult. And so a bunch of us girls got invited to a party. Some older guy was throwing a party, and he provided alcohol, and none of us knew how to handle it. We'd only ever heard of people, like other kids at our high school drinking. There was a rumor that someone had snuck alcohol into grad night at Disneyland. Crazy rumors that don't even make sense, but we were all like sharing these rumors, like that they had a syringe and they injected oranges with the alcohol so that they could. So I don't get it. I don't know how I believed that years later, when after I was married and had a kid, I took my kid to a special event at Disneyland, and she might have been 5 or 7 years old, and we were riding the Haunted Mansion. That cool time of year when it's between Halloween and Christmas, so it's like a mixture of motifs. And we ended up in the car with two other people, and I started smelling different kind of smoke. And just as soon as I looked, one person finished and passed it to the other person, and someone like a spy in a fully black suit peeled themselves off the wall and got that person and pulled them out. And they went to Disneyland jail. You know there was Disneyland jail. So, I mean, we could talk all night about the stories that surround using and abusing. And so, you know, I was googly-eyed about alcohol, and my daughter ended up doing the same thing. I remember her resenting that her brother, half-brother, her dad, my first husband, took her half-brother out for his 18th birthday for beers. I don't know what state they found where it was legal, but, you know, she was 21 before her dad sat down and offered her alcohol. So, anyway, man, I just feel, it felt like, to me, like there was sort of a strike against me going into this rite of passage. So the party with the older guy inviting a bunch of young girls to a party and waking up without clothes on in his bed just before my 18th birthday. And not knowing to this day exactly what happened, I'm pretty sure that everything was above board, but I can't really be sure. And you would think that that was enough for me to be scared off about alcohol, but I was going to college soon, and there it was some more. There was pressure to drink. You got teased or mocked if you didn't drink. Folks bragged about how much liquor they could hold. And so I became that person. And, you know, we all wanted to be the life of the party. And I managed to get through it. I got engaged. I graduated. And within a year, we had our daughter. And within 2 years, we were separated and divorced. And so I drove back up here to Santa Maria to announce to the family that we were separated and soon to be divorced. And the reason at that time, okay, so first the mystique around alcohol and it as you get to drink when you're grown up. And the other part of this was a coming of age story for me, a coming out story in my family. I had married the first guy I fell in love with when I was 17, and we were together until I was 26, and then we separated, and I confided in one of my siblings that I was going to be coming out to the family, that I'd be bringing, you know, the grandchild up. She was almost 2 by then. And so when I got to the house, everyone was real somber, and they'd gathered the whole family, and I noticed that the gold leaf family Bible was out, open to a certain several pages, I think Leviticus. And I reported that, I'm sorry to say that I'm getting a divorce, and I explained why briefly, I tried to be really brief about it. And my father read from scripture and said that I would not be joining them down the line in heaven. And my mother said that I was unfit to raise a child. So I stood up and I took the baby and I went back to the car and I thought, and I started driving south again. I was living in San Diego at the time, and I thought to myself, I'm never coming back here, ever. I can't come back here because I am fit to raise a child. I am a good mother, and this is one aspect of who I am, just one. And so a lot has happened between then and now. it took me many years. In fact, it took almost two decades for me to realize that one of the most important things in life and one of the hardest things in life is for me to walk a mile in your shoes. And I had to do that with those family members. I had to remember that they came from small town Minnesota, that they had caught, you know, they had five kids and had raised these, you know, just were kind of pretty sheltered. They didn't drink. I didn't see that in the home. It skipped a generation. And eventually I could drive back up here with that kid as she grew up, and carry my head high. At the same time, I was developing a serious, serious drinking problem. After the divorce, I had to get two jobs to make ends meet. I got written off of the title to the house. And so I started working really hard. And when it was time to hand kid off to the co-parent, it was on. And at that time, for LGBTQ folks, the only place, you know, this was only the early 90s, you guys. It's not like the 60s or the 70s when folks really had to hide out. But still, at that time, there was really only the bars to go to be ourselves and to be safe. And, you know, at that time, it worked for kind of a martyr storyline for me, my narrative. Like, oh, this is the only place I get to be. Serve me another. But soon I realized that was really an excuse. Really an excuse. And I was seeing somebody at that time, and both of us drank a lot, and we were out one night. This is the first time in my life, in my early 30s, I realized that I had a problem, that I had really developed a problem. Now, my twin sister and I, take back one step, my twin sister and I had agreed during college, when we both were out somewhere drinking, that if we ever thought the other one was developing a, that we said, if you think I'm developing a problem, let me know. Let me know. And like the good Al-Anon that I am, I let her know that she was developing a problem. That was like in our late 20s. But by our early 30s, there's an old Sheryl Crow or Sean Colvin song that says, I used to have to drink to get my spark. And I could work an 8-hour day. I was holding down my job. It would be real rough until at some point during the day I thought about, what's happening tonight? Where am I going to do my drinking tonight? Is there something in the fridge? Is there some event, some excuse of an event I can go to? And so I was out one night with a big group of friends, including the person I was dating at the time. And carefully nursing drinks in order to stay in control. It was a big deal coming up that you do not ever act out of control. You know how kids get the spazzies, and with five kids in the Star household, you know, there was a lot going on. But as soon as Pops walked into the room, a pall fell over the room. And so I really learned that, like, always stay in control. Always manage the message. Always control the narrative. Do damage control later. I mean, it's just really shocking how clear that whole agenda was. So we were there with all our friends, dressed to the nines after work, and I noticed that she was getting a little sloppy, and I was starting to be aware of it. Perfect Al-Anon. And I'm drinking too. And she came up behind me and just crammed her hand down the front of my blouse. And I took her hand away and headed for the door, and she followed me outside. And I turned around, and I remember that funny spin, like that vertiginous spin, you know, like I'm going, I think the world, okay, we're here, okay, we're back. The world is here. We're back. And I started to say, you're a drunk. And I pointed at her. But I said, you're a drunk. And I felt my hand just turn like this. Just turn. And I just stopped in my tracks, and I thought, I'm a drunk. Not drunk. It's that one letter in between there has been crucial for me in my self-awareness. I'm a drunk. And I said, I'm leaving. And I, you know, that night I was honest and I walked it off. I got to my car. I saw her trying to back out and run into the cars in front and behind her. And a guy stumbling out from a neighborhood, another bar, neighboring bar. And they're laughing with each other and both driving off. And I waited a while and I drove home. And I promised myself on the drive home that I would never drink again. I got up the next morning, showered, got dressed up for work, made it there 5 minutes before I was supposed to clock in, got out of my car in the parking lot, and remembered the promise I had made to myself. Because I must have been thinking about what I was going to be drinking that night just to get through the day. And I remembered, Star, you promised yourself you would never drink again. And I kid you not, my legs gave out from underneath me. I was on my hands and knees in the parking lot, like I'd been many times before for much different reasons, you know, for stumbling drunk. And I just sobbed. I just sobbed. It felt like I'd just been through the worst breakup of my life. That's how dependent I had become on alcohol, that it was like a lover, and that they had broken up with me. And I just sobbed. I eventually got my composure, went into work, and went that night and found a meeting. The meeting, it's a long story, but the meeting, I just didn't find what I was looking for, and I found all the reasons to walk right back out the door. I'm sure some of you can relate to this. It's a long story, but just the conversation that was going on, I couldn't identify with anybody, and nope, this is not the place for me, and I white-knuckled it for 3 years. And then I thought I outsmarted this disease, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I came back in, and that time I was here for 5 years. I got a sponsor and I worked the steps. And at that time, my pops developed Parkinson's. And he was lucky to be at home. And we didn't know, but he only had a few weeks left. And I was working my steps and it was time for me to make amends to him. And I wanted to hear, I'm sorry, from him. I wanted to hear, I'm sorry, from him. And I sat down next to the bed. He was in real late stage where, like, dabbing, like the little sponge with water, like dabbing on their lips or something. And I had a zipper hoodie on. And I knew I had to do it. My sponsor wanted me to, and I knew it was the right thing to do. And I said, Pops, I'm sorry for my part in things, and I forgive you for yours. And he had barely moved for a week or 10 days. And he reached over and zipped up the zipper on my hoodie. And I just chose to hear, take care of yourself, kid. You got this. Anybody ever tried surfing, or any surfers in here? Or skaters? Yeah. There's a moment when you're paddling for a wave and you've got to get, like, if it's smooth enough, when the waves are really glassy, you've got to get your board going with the speed of the wave. Otherwise, you're going to get tossed because it'll just sort of catch up and roll over you. So you paddle, you're watching the wave, and everything kind of starts in slow motion, right, Norm? Like, you start to feel the force of the wave because there's, I think, like 30 tons of pressure in each 1 foot of a wave. And at that moment, you have a choice. Now, use this for anything hard that you're facing in your life, or any new skill you're trying to pick up, or your favorite thing to do that has some fear around it, or just something hard. You know, if you can't relate to the surfing part of it, identify with it with something for yourself. So you have a choice to either say, you got this. You got this. And to picture yourself catching the wave, pushing up, standing up, and riding this wave. And when you do that, oh man, just life doesn't get much better than that. Or you can say, don't mess up. Don't mess up. There was a study years ago done with, do you remember Jackie Joyner Kersee and Flo-Jo and Jackie? I think it was the 84 Olympics or something, the runners, the gorgeous get-ups and the long nails. And they were sisters-in-law. And when they were training out at the track for the Pan American Games, I want to say, some researchers came out. I think they were in sociology and psychology. And the sister-in-laws were training with each other. And they brought one, Flo-Jo, to one side and Jackie to the other. And they said, Flo-Jo, when you run the mile today against your sister-in-law, run as hard as you can. Push yourself as hard as you can. And she said, that's what I do all the time. That's how I win medals. And they said, today, run as hard as you can and talk up to yourself. No negative self-talk. Just decide on something like, you got this. And keep it in mind the whole time that you run the mile, right? Which is four laps. And out of earshot of Flo, did I say Flo for this one? Jackie, they said, Jackie, today when you run as hard as you can. She said, that's what I always do. What's the difference? And they said, today, what do you think? Talk down to yourself. Push yourself as hard as you can, but talk down to yourself. And she said, what do you mean? Like, I can't even wrap my brain around that. They said, think of something. You're going to lose. Or don't mess up. So they went and they lined up and they blew the whistle and the sisters-in-law started to run against each other. And Flo-Jo took off. Jackie took off. Jackie's talking down to herself. Flo-Jo's talking up to herself. And Flo-Jo starts to pull ahead. And she wins the race by 10 strides. And Jackie says, Flo, what? I mean, Flo says to Jackie, what happened? And Jackie said, they told me to talk down to myself the whole time. She said, I can't believe how that affected my behavior. Because I pushed myself physically as hard as I could. So we got this. Sobriety isn't easy. And the ticket is right here on the wall, right here. And if you get to the searching and fearless moral inventory of yourself, for example, and you start to doubt yourself or think, I can't, what an order, I can't go through with it, right, Kim? think to yourself and use your name. They say to use your own first name. Star, you got this. Think of all the things you've gotten through. Really? You're going to let a notebook and a pen scare you? Now, my sponsor had me go through the 8-column fourth step. I mean, she was serious. She was serious. By the time I would get to the 8th column, that situation that I was so burnt up on that had such a resentment all those years was immediately lifted off of my shoulders. I'll give you an example. By the time I did that fourth step, 45 years before, I had been turned down for a job that I worked really hard to get, and the worst part of it, I expected to get. There were 10 people on the interview committee. I thought I knocked it out of the park. I got called back for the second interview. And then I got the note saying, sorry, we've gone with someone else. And I lugged that resentment around for 45 years. You ever see The Mission with Robert De Niro and Jeremy Irons? And De Niro's a mercenary, and he's trying to atone for his crimes, his sins. And he's lugging his weapons behind him into the Brazilian rainforest. And the indigenous folks that he wronged so bad are seeing him do this. And one comes out and cuts the weight off of him and it tumbles down. My fourth step was like that. I wrote down, the resentment. I resent this and that organization for not hiring me. And by the time I got to the contrary action, the entire thing was lifted off my shoulders. Because you know what I realized? Just in the process of writing it down, there's no amends to make to anybody except myself for lugging that resentment around for that long, for not being accountable and taking responsibility for that. I wouldn't have hired myself either. I wouldn't have. I used to go into work. That's the same job I'm talking about, like being in the car, you know, outside the car on my hands and knees crying because I had to stop drinking. The other car I had was a VW bus, and they had like these vinyl kind of cheesy, like fake plaid seats or something. I don't know how to explain it, but it's like printed, like plaid or something. I don't know. But there were times where I went in to work with the print on the side of my face. Man, I had some good sleeps in that van. I would not have hired myself either, and that's what the gift of the steps gave to me, and it's worked for every single resentment I've ever carried around in my life. And what works for me, what has worked for me, is to voice it to the person, if I can, who I need to make amends to, or to make living amends for the newcomers. Oh, by the way, congratulations. I said that. The newcomers and the chip takers and anybody else who didn't step up. Living amends is absolutely magical. There's someone we really gave a hard time to in high school. I knew that I was taking the uncertainty and the fear and the anonymous grief and everything that was going on at home, and I was just dishing it out to you guys out at school. And boy, was I tough. Boy, we were just relentless on some kids. And I still have a heavy heart about that. There's still a few that I have not been able to reach. One in particular. And so living amends, no one knows whether they're living anymore or not. But living amends means finding every opportunity that we can to make up for what we did. To be a little bit more compassionate towards you when you're ahead of me in line in the 12 and under line with 13 items. Someone, was it last week? Anna, who spoke here and did such a great job last week. Something about like, what is it? Serenity is not being bothered by the person in front of you who has 13 items in a 12 items or less line at the grocery store. But somehow, like, peace is doing that, but really true serenity is not counting. True serenity is not counting their stuff. And I get that every time I walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You show me grace. You give me a chance to start over. Maybe I stepped on your toes last meeting. Maybe I shared something really personal that you just weren't ready to hear that day. Maybe I said something that resonated so closely that it sent you away just having some kind of irritation, like, ooh, something came up there and I can't quite put my finger on it. And we get to start over together. That's the gift that every single one of you is giving to me right now, sitting here listening to me, and that I'm trying to afford to you. And that's living amends. For all the times we didn't sit in a room like this and show respect to each other and give each other the dignity of our own journeys and not take each other's inventories. 12 days, 3 years, 7. Who's got 20 years or more? Raise your hand. Jim? Marianne? Bob? Yeah? Kathy? Awesome. Cindy? I thought I saw, yeah. I want what you have. And the only way I'm going to get there is by listening to you, trusting you with your story, respecting your anonymity, being humble, asking you after a meeting if you didn't share, if there's something you would have shared if there'd been time. going out and having fun. I'm noticing some changes because my home group's in San Francisco, but I'm watching really amazing recovery happening in this community, in this district. I'm seeing younger folks coming in and following Rule 62. Right, Mary, never take yourself too damn seriously. There's folks after the Friday night meeting, the grapevine meeting, thanks, going bowling afterwards, doing karaoke, and also sometimes going and doing H&I, because what aids in our recovery? Service. You're doing a service to yourself right now. You're doing a service to me, to the community, being here instead of somewhere else, working hard on yourself. And it's a beautiful thing. You might be wondering, last thing, you might be wondering about higher power and as that as a part of my journey, because that heavy scripture that I know means a lot to a lot of people in this room. I hope that that story of mine and that experience of mine does not speak to your experience and your faith practice at all. That wasn't my intention at all. It's taken me a long time to come back around, to walk a mile in their shoes. Eventually, within like a year, I drove back up kind of timidly with my kid and let them get to know her, let them watch the kind of parent I was together, kind of communally to raise this amazing kid who's 34 now, who actually quit drinking before I did, even though she doesn't identify as an alcoholic. And without even saying it, she said, "Mama, I know you can do this too." So we've managed to come to sort of peace. And now I'm the one who's here available in the family to help my mom in her last weeks or days or months. Who knows? So there's so much grace in this program. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Thanks.
Yeah.